The songs of Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. You lost that love and feeling. Oh, that love and feeling. You lost that love and feeling. Now it's gone, gone, gone. Oh, oh, oh.
I love how your eyes
with a trace of misty morning and a promise of tomorrow in her eyes. I just can't help believing when she's lying close beside me and my heart beats with the rhythm of her sighs. This time the girl is gonna stay. This time the girl is gonna stay for more than just a day.
In the eyes of my woman I stand like a hero, a giant, a man who's as tall as can be. Any fool can see.
right in the door, just like you've done before, and wrap my heart round your little finger.
That was just a mere sampling of the Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil Hall of Fame. Together they've written a long list of major hit songs. On a few they've collaborated with other writers such as Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller and Phil Spector, and more recently with Tom Snow on the Linda Ronstadt era Neville smash Don't Know Much. Individually they've also collaborated with key co-writers, Barry with Jerry Goffin, Howard Greenfield and Leo Sayer, Cynthia with both Jerry Goffin and Carole King, Rick Derringer and Lionel Richie. But it's together that Barry and Cynthia have become one of the longest lasting and most consistently successful songwriting teams. Later on this tape, we'll be playing complete versions of some songs from the existing EMI catalogues, which we all feel are worthy of a second life. To put it all in perspective, we asked Barry and Cynthia to guide us through the early days of their career when they were two of the staff writers at Al Nevins and Don Kirshner's publishing company called Alden Music, which later became Screen Gems. How did you start writing together?
Well, I had already been signed to Nevins Kirshner or Alden Music, and I had come up, I went to play a song for an artist named Teddy Randazzo, a song I had written with Howie Greenfield. It was called The Way of a Clown. And I went up to Kenny Greengrass's office. Kenny Greengrass was Teddy Randazzo's manager. And lo and behold, standing next to Teddy Randazzo was Cynthia Weil, was this girl Cynthia Weil, who I thought was Teddy Randazzo's girlfriend, and probably was. To this day, she won't tell me. But anyway, and that's how we met. And Cynthia saw me and followed me everywhere. I couldn't get her off my... I said, get out of here, kid. No, I played the song, and Teddy Randazzo loved the song, and he ended up recording it. And I was the A side, and Cynthia, who was writing with Teddy at the time, was the B side. What was the name of your song? I forgot the name.
Cherie,
right. So that was the beginning.
Was he on ABC?
ABC Paramount.
Right, which was the label you were on when you did
Who Put the Bomb. That's right.
Small world.
Yes.
I'd like to thank the guy who wrote the song, who made my baby fall in love with me. Who put the bomb in the bomb, bomb, bomb? Who put the ram in the ram-a-lam-a ding dong? Who put the bop in the bop, shabop, shabop? Who put the dip in the dip, 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 dip? Who was that man? I'd like to shake his hand. He made my baby fall in love with me.
I go back a little bit as well, because I started with EMI Records in 61, and I was very into collecting not just EMI records, but all the records from the competitor companies. And about March 61, there was a really terrible British duo called the Brook Brothers, who had a song called War Paint.
Oh, that was
my song.
Right, absolutely.
I wrote that with Howie Greenfield. That was my first English hit, I think.
Right. Which was never a hit here.
No, it wasn't a hit here. That's right. I remember
it was
that.
A big song. It was like a top five.
A top five record.
Barry
That's right.
Recorded that song, and it was, and he released it as an artist here.
I don't know if I released it.
Yes,
I did.
Right.
I didn't remember. Yeah, I recorded
was
for
it
ABC
on the ABC album. Probably.
Yeah, before I think it was right before I had a hit with Who Put the Bomb.
Right.
I had recorded War Paint also.
And then Who Put the Bomb was covered in England as well by the Viscounts.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So, what was your first hit together?
It was a song called
Bless You.
Oh, sung by Tony Orlando.
Right.
Before Dawn.
Whose wedding we just went to.
That's right.
Every time I face the world, I just had to cry. I stood alone with no love of my own, but then you have been by. Oh, child,
Tony Orlando, did he do demos for Alden?
He kind of did demos, but I think Donny Kirshner and Carol... Well, Donny Kirshner was kind of grooming him as the white Benny King.
Tony was 16, and he was kind of like the in-house boy singer.
Yeah. Right. Tony was a great singer. I mean, he really...
Yes.
He sang very soulfully.
Soulful. Halfway to Paradise.
That's right.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Terrific, terrific song.
But I remember Barry wrote a song with Larry Kober called... what was it called?
It's Everlasting.
It's Everlasting.
Yeah.
And Tony did a vocal version, Barry did a vocal version, and Brooks Arthur did a vocal version.
Oh.
And Tony's version brought me to tears.
It was so soulful
and touching.
Very touching, yeah.
So now the early Don Kirshner, Al Nevins team of writers was you?
It was Cynthia and myself. It was Carol King and Jerry Goffin.
Right.
It was Howie Greenfield and Neil Sedaka. Then right. Carol Bayer came in a little bit later.
She only had two names then.
That's right. Right.
And, right.
That's how far back it was.
That's right. Before that, she had one name. And before that, she just had a letter. It was just a C. When she was born, it was just a C. Then there was a fellow named Jack Keller.
Right, I know.
Who wrote Everybody Somebody's Fool and wrote, what else did Jack write?
Mind of Its Own.
And let's see who else. There was Larry Kolber, and there was a guy named Mike Anthony I wrote some hits with.
Right, and Hank Hunter.
Hank Hunter, sure.
Everybody talks about the Brill Building, and I'm sure there are a lot of wrong stories out there about it, but about all the different writers and publishers in one building, although it was probably more than one building.
It was. As a matter of fact, we were not in the Brill Building. We were in 1650 Broadway, which was two blocks north.
One thing I've always been fascinated by, you guys seemed so prolific in those days. What was the schedule of your writing? I mean, did you just sit and write?
All the time?
Yeah.
That was it.
Okay.
Yeah, when we took time off to eat, we felt guilty.
That's right, yes. Yeah. To this day, I feel guilty.
It's true. But, I mean, we certainly have come to terms with learning how to fit life in around writing. Right. But definitely life... Now we fit writing in around life.
Yeah,
but then...
Yeah.
Life was something that we slipped in between writing sessions and demo sessions.
Yeah, we were the Diane Warrens of our time.
Right.
We had no life. Our only friends were Carol and Jerry because, and their only friends were us because no one else would put up with
a friend who never saw them.
We kept
an eye on each other, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like we would also take vacations together because we'd be afraid that if we were away on a vacation, they'd be writing hits.
Right.
And the same thing.
So we had a ski house and we had them up every weekend so we could watch them.
And they hated skiing, but we made them ski. No, it was, we were very competitive.
We had a lot of fun together.
Yeah, we really did.
They're great people.
Right. Freaking out on acid and stuff like that. I was fantastic. Having breakdowns and stuff.
Oh, it's almost time for Araldo. What was the average turnaround between when you wrote a song and when you demoed it? I mean, did you demoed it in the same
three building? 3 minutes.
I mean, we'd write it next week. We'd be in demoing it, and sometimes within the next month you'd hear it on the air. That's how fast the turnaround was from writing to instant gratification of having the hit.
It's perfect. It was a perfect business for childish people
who
needed instant gratification.
Yeah,
you
couldn't
wrote
wait.
It, and that was out until 2 weeks later. It was amazing.
Another thing I've always wanted to ask you was in 1963, you were on a roll already with Patches by Dickie Lee and Blame It on the Bossa Nova, Edie Gourmet and things like that.
Uptown, I think.
And then you collaborated with Lieber and Stoller on a couple of songs.
Yeah.
And I always wonder how two teams of writers collaborate on two big songs.
How did that
come together?
Well, you know, they were very good producers. And they were cutting the Drifters at the time and a lot of other acts. And the Drifters were up to record, and we had written a song called On Broadway. This is before we ever got together with Mike and Jerry.
Right.
And we played them the song. And
as a matter of fact, we had written it because Carol and Jerry were cutting a group called The Cookies.
Right.
And they were one song short. And, you know, that's the only reason they came to us. They were desperate.
Right. Yeah.
So we wrote this song called On Broadway, which it was from a girl's point of view about coming to Broadway from a small town and trying to make it. And it was... it had the same opening lines, but from then on, the lyric was different. And the melody was...
Very slightly different.
Was
very slight.
Different.
The original was... They say the neon lights are bright. No, the lights are bright on Broadway. It was more Gershwin-esque in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they didn't have on Broadway, you know, that kind of thing. And it didn't modulate three times. That was Mike Stoller's idea, if I remember.
Yeah.
And basically, they liked the song, but they felt it was the wrong
perspective. We're back to Lieber and Stoller
now.
Because
we played it for them. They liked the song, but they felt it was the wrong point of view for the Drifters. So they said, why don't you rewrite it? And I think we suggested...
No. They said, look, we need to be able to play this by tomorrow.
Right.
You can either go home and try to get something that will please us by yourselves, let's all get together and do this. And, I mean, we idolized them. The idea of writing in the same room with them was thrilling.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On Broadway.
They say there's always
I learned more at that time. I was just starting. I learned more from writing with Jerry on that song than I could have in any songwriting school.
Yeah, it was very exciting.
It was very exciting. It was so.
The whole writing process was totally different than yours. I know.
Yeah, it was.
He just shot lines out. He was
much looser.
Really, yeah.
He would start if he got. We had these opening lines, and we had a hard time getting the second part of the first verse, and. My method would have been to stay there and pound my head against the wall until I got it. And Jerry said, no, we go on, and then we go back. And if we don't get it, then we go on to something else, and then we go back. And he kind of taught me how to leap around in a song and work on it that way instead of paralyzing yourself.
Just a little side thing. I mean, as we were writing, there's a little kid crawled into the room, his son. Uh-huh. Little Oliver came in there.
Little Oliver Lieber.
Who's now producing...
Paula Abdul
and the world, as a matter of fact.
Probably learned everything in those
that
5 minutes.
I remember. He kept looking up.
He
and
stood
said,
up and
more.
Said, yes, right. Teach me songs.
Right.
Anyway. Was Magic Town, was that an answer to On Broadway?
No.
It's kind of all seemed related to me.
No, you know, I produced that record.
You know, for some reason, that was a big theme of mine for a while, about somebody having nothing and trying to get away from someplace and have something. It was... Mm-hmm. You know, it's like On Broadway, it's Uptown, it's
right.
Magic Town, it's a lot of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I guess it was my hunger period.
That's right. That's why you were hungry.
Picasso has his blue period.
Right, yes.
I wanted to know, what were you listening to when you were growing up and at that time? What music was influencing you?
Well, when I was growing up, I was listening to, this is before rock and roll ever made it, I was listening to Martin Block's Make Believe Ballroom. It was on Sunday on ABC, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it would play the top 25, I think, or the top 20, top 30. It was, you know, it was all those pop singers, Frankie Lane and Patti Page and
Joe Stafford.
Joe Stafford, I didn't like him. Yeah. I mean, I loved Frankie Lane. He was like, the Neil Diamond of his era, you know what I'm saying?
Right. Right. Really, when he actually recorded a song of ours.
He actually recorded a song of ours later on.
And he called us the geniuses.
And he felt it was destined, because I told him I was a huge fan of his.
Yeah.
He says, and God made this happen. I know it did. And as a matter of fact, he had a hit. Was it a hit?
Yes, it was called Don't Make My Baby Blue.
Oh, yes.
So I was listening to that. And then I started, when rock and roles. I remember people saying this new thing called Moondog, I think they called it at the time.
Oh, the Alan Freed?
Alan Freed, Moondog. Right. And I started to listen, and I thought, God, they sing flat, and I couldn't believe it. And after about 3 weeks, I got to love it. I don't know what it was. It was just something so visceral about it that I just got to love.
Did you both like the same kind of music of that
Well, time? I yes. really grew up. I also listened to Make Believe Ballroom a lot.
By the way, I listened to classical music too when I was younger too. Anyway,
and what I loved was shows, Broadway show music, and those were the lyrics that I was interested in. I thought rock and roll was stupid. I mean, I didn't get it at all. Barry kind of educated me as far as rock and roll.
I said, this is what it is, kid.
You said, write it.
It's animalistic kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Because didn't you have a connection with the Frank Lesser Publishing Company?
Frank Lesser's company was the first place that ever gave me encouragement as a writer. I had auditioned for an agent who was on the same floor as Frank Lesser's Publishing Company. I was singing then, and he said, you can't sing, kid, but who wrote your lyrics? And I had written them. So he introduced me to Frank Lesser, who was great. We went up to meet him at 7 in the morning was when he took his meetings, because then he wrote all day, didn't want to be interrupted. And he set me up at the publishing company, and they started putting me together with writers. And that was the first kind of commercial writing. And now that I look back, it wasn't really commercial at all. It wasn't rock and roll. It was kind of more the shishi in-between stuff. But it was my first experience of writing with different people and, you know, kind of getting into the world of songwriting.
I was intrigued to know what you were listening to, because your music has such a range of it.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, in later years, country and R&B. But in those days, so many people were just writing ballads and pop songs.
Right.
And you wrote some great ones. But as you were hinting at a moment ago, you were getting into protest songs. I mean,
right.
You listened to We Gotta Get Out of This Place.
We wrote Uptown in 1961.
Yeah, 61.
It was a hit in 62.
It was probably the first sociological hit.
He gets up each morning and he goes downtown, where everyone's his boss and he's lost in an angry land. He's a little man, but then he comes uptown each evening to my tenement, uptown where folks don't have to pay much rent. And when he's there with me, he can see that he's
I don't know why. I was always interested in that stuff. Yeah. I think when you're very young, you think that you can change the world with your songs. And
yeah. Once rock and roll hit, I started listening to everything. I mean, and I liked a lot of it. So I really learned a lot by listening. And I listened to country and what was called R&B at the time, you know, pop and just a whole kind of
conglomeration.
Yeah.
How did the Animals get to record We Gotta Get Out of This Place?
An old story, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, what is
the old story?
That's a tender spot.
I wrote the song, and truthfully, we wrote the song for the Righteous
Brothers. We wrote the song for the Righteous Brothers, and it was very Righteous Brothers.
Yeah, and I cut a spectacular demo.
One of the great demos of all time.
In this dirty part of the city, where the sun forgets to shine, people say they're just ain't no use in trying. They ain't no use in trying. Oh, girl, now you're young and oh so pretty. Staying here would be a crime. 'Cause you just grow old before your time. Yes, you will.
Redbird Records, which was George Golden's and Lee Bernstolle's label. Mickey Most had called us up, and for some reason, I don't know, we had given him the song for the Animals.
I don't know how he got it.
But anyway, we forgot that he even had the song, all right?
Right.
By then, George Golden heard my demo. He said, this is an absolute smash. And he had it ready.
It was pressed.
This was pressed to go out as a record. And that day, Kirshner called me into his office, and he told me that the Animals had released We Gotta Get Out of This Place, and he even knew they had recorded it, and it was number two in England.
And then we heard the record, and I almost went nuts because they had cut out and changed half the lyric. I still, to this day, have a hard time listening to that song because it's not the song we wrote, and I've always hoped that someday someone would record it right. And as a matter of fact, Katrina and the Waves included in it a lot of the old
lyric.
Lyric.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the duet they did with Eric Burdon for China Beach.
Right. Barry's record was so close to coming out, and we both loved it, and we loved the song, and so...
So the song never got to the Rogers Brothers?
I don't think it did.
No, I don't think it did.
I never made it there.
Now, is it true that you wrote You've Lost That Loving Feeling in a Hollywood hotel room?
Yes, we wrote it in the Chateau Marmont. Okay. We came out here to write with Phil Spector. And the only place that took dogs was the Chateau Marmont. We had a German Shepherd.
We had a dog with us.
Beautiful German Shepherd. And we rented a piano and started writing there.
Now, that song, you can't imagine anybody else recording other than the Righteous Brothers.
Except there's been about 300 records.
Yeah, I know, but that, when you hear it,
yeah, it belongs to the Righteous Brothers. It's the ultimate.
No matter
record.
Who else sings it.
Yeah. But, the standard Love and Feeling story was when Barry played it for Bill and Bobby and they thought it would be good for the Everly Brothers.
Well, I did sing kind of like the Everly Brothers at the time.
And then, of course, Bobby was not thrilled about not having anything to do for the whole first verse.
Yes, so what did Phil tell him?
Yeah, so he said something about, what am I supposed to do while the big guy's singing? And Phil said, you can go to the bank.
You could be walking to the bank with him.
Oh, it's a wonderful line. Are there any times when you've heard re-recordings of songs which were big hits originally, but you hear a re-recording and it puts the song in not only a different light, but the way that it always
On Broadway was a great example of that. The original record was a great record, The Drifters. But the George Benson record, not only that, but seeing the film and hearing it. All that jazz was fantastic. It was done so beautifully. It was great.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway. Say there's always magic in the air. But when you're walking down that street and you ain't had enough to eat, the glitter rubs right off and you're nowhere.
Right, when you see it edited to the movement on the screen, it's almost as if you wrote it for the picture.
Then I heard, Sometimes When We Touch. I wrote Sometimes When We Touch with Dan Hill.
Right.
And then at one point I heard Demis Russo's Italian version of it, which you couldn't even understand the lyric, but it was incredible. It was absolutely beautiful. Yeah.
And hearing Darlene Love do that live. When We Touch, she was at Club Lingerie here, and she did her version
beautiful
of Sometimes When We Touch. That was just, people went nuts. It was extraordinary.
Yeah.
Mentioning Darlene Love and immediately thinking of girl groups, I have to share what I discovered only the first time we met just a few months ago. Something about a group called The Girls who were on Capitol. That was always one of my favorite records, Chico's Girl.
And I
used it on a package, and I always wondered who the girls were, and then it turned out that you were the lead singer.
Yeah.
That's right, sang Leon.
That's right.
Chico wears a jacket that says Rebels on the back. His neighborhood's a jungle, so he travels with a pack. When folks say he's bad, like they always do, I get so mad, 'cause I know it really ain't true. And I should know, 'cause I'm Chico's girl.
So now, who said that you couldn't sing?
Oh,
it was wrong.
I did.
It was wrong.
No.
It was at a period when
there was this like young bad girl sound. Right. I was in great demand for demos.
Right. For about
it lasted
3 months.
About 20 minutes.
Yeah, it was kind of almost had a Shangri-La's feel to it.
Yes,
like
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, that's about as how good I sang was the Shangri-La's.
Well, we're talking about you doing demos. Did you sing on some of your demos as well?
Only for, that short period of time when you needed to sound very young and very bad. And then I did a demo for Carol and Jerry.
That's right.
I did a demo for Sylvester Bradford.
Right.
I had,
Home with Boy I Love.
And which Donnie Rubin and a guy named Charlie Koppelman sang backup.